CRJ225, this is your podcast for week number 3. And as promised, we are going to move on to the defenses of infancy, insanity, intoxication, and negligence. You need to find the Illinois statutes on infancy, insanity, and intoxication. And those statutes are able to be at least initially located on the Canvas site. But part of this task is to get you familiar with Illinois statutes again. And we've been working on that. After that, we're going to take a little closer focus. So, you know, the first thing I want you to do is that and as a hint, as I noted in the assignment form, the statutes are back to back, so you only have to look in one place. They're all together. But read these statutes, preferably go and find and read these statutes before you listen to this podcast and then come back. If you've already read the statutes, you know that we're going to go back to the insanity defense. I need you to go and read that again before you start the assignment. And I've also provided a case, People versus Romero, that you're going to read and summarize. And be sure you get those things done by the deadlines, which again are Thursday at 10 p.m. of this week for your original post. And then Monday of week 4 at 10 p.m. for your responses or reviews of other students' posts. So Article 6, as you know by now, is titled Responsibility. It infers a focus on whether the defendant has the capacity to be responsible for his or her actions. It breaks down infancy, intoxication, and insanity as defenses that can be raised by the defendant as to why they should not be responsible for their actions. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time, or we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on infancy and intoxication, but infancy is covered in Section 6.1, and that statute says that no person shall be convicted of any offense unless he had attained his 13th birthday at the time the offense was committed. Again, I'm not going to spend a lot of time here because most of you will take juvenile delinquency. Suffice it to say, we see this defense debated more and more often as juveniles and very young kids commit heinous acts that we typically associate with adults. Clearly committing, you know, intentional acts, firing a weapon at someone, as an example, with an intent to harm or kill that individual. And I linked an article, or I'll link an article later this week when I post my comments. Shows a, you know, an example of a 9-year-old boy who was charged with murder. Most of the time in this situation, this gets sorted out in the charging phase that you're now familiar with a decision in most cases to bring the child through the juvenile justice system. Intoxication is covered in 6.3, and intoxication, that's titled intoxicated or drugged condition. A person who is in an intoxicated or drug condition is criminally responsible for conduct unless that condition is involuntarily produced. So in other words, it's not an excuse that you were intoxicated, but you went to the bar and you sat at the bar and you drank and then, you know, this act occurred. Or you voluntarily participated in using some sort of narcotic, put yourself in a drugged condition. Now, drug condition is not illegal drugs. People can be in a drugged condition from prescriptions. If you've ever had prescriptions that give you warnings, you know, if you do the things that the warnings say you shouldn't do, well, that's a drug condition. It doesn't say that it has to be something legal or illegal. But the main point there is involuntary. Involuntary intoxication or drug conditions are rare, and remember, the defendant must prove their defense. So, you know, think of some really good facts, witnesses, and proof that the intoxication was not of their free will. They get tricked, drugged, whatever, but they didn't choose to drink or take whatever substance that ended up in their system and then had no knowledge of their act. Now, you'll note that negligence, failure to take proper care in doing something, is not a defense to a criminal charge. And we'll get into why this is so in later weeks when we really get into the elements and drive home other factors. But, you know, the example, an easy example would be if we're both in the parking lot at Illinois Central College and you're not paying attention to what you're doing, and I'm walking through the parking lot and, you know, you're fiddling with the your phone or radio or something, and you don't see me and you strike me with your vehicle, that's negligence. You didn't intend to do it. If you're upset about the grade I gave you and you say, "There's Higgins," come flying at me, obviously that's not negligence. So negligence isn't a defense to a criminal charge, but negligence doesn't come with intent, and so it's not applicable to the criminal charge. And you're not going to be charged with a criminal act if the facts are that you were negligent, not intent on committing an act. So we're going to focus mostly on the one that does get a lot of attention, and that's insanity, and that's found under 6.2. A person is not criminally responsible for conduct if at the time of such conduct, as a result of a mental disease or mental defect, is how the statute reads, he lacks substantial capacity to appreciate the criminality of his conduct. Lacks substantial capacity to appreciate the criminality of his conduct. If you've ever seen, you know, an expert witness, a psychiatrist, psychologist hired by the defendant, or in that, to that matter, hired by the prosecution, if this defense is raised, that's the language that they'll use. You know, the defendant's expert will say that he or she lacked substantial capacity to appreciate the criminality of their conduct, meaning they lacked the ability to determine that it, you know, what they were doing was criminal, and they just in essence had no intent. The terms mental disease or mental defect don't include abnormally manifested situations. It's only by repeated criminal or otherwise antisocial conduct. Now, a person who at the time of the commission of the criminal offense was not insane but was suffering from a mental illness is not relieved of criminal responsibility for his conduct and may be found guilty but mentally ill. For purposes of this section, again, mentally ill, by the statute, it's defined as a substantial disorder of thought, mood, or behavior which afflicted a person at the time of the commission of the offense, and it impaired the person's judgment, but not to the extent that the person is unable to appreciate the wrongfulness of their behavior. Now, when the defense of insanity has been presented during the trial, the burden of proof is on the defendant to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the defendant is not guilty by reason of insanity. However, remember, the burden of proof remains on the state or the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt each of the elements of the underlying offense, the offense the person is charged with. If there's a jury, the jury has to be instructed that it may not consider whether a defendant has met his burden of proving that he is not guilty by reason of insanity until and unless it's first determined that the state has proven the defendant was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of the offense. So the state has to prove its case. If the jury believes that the state's proved their case beyond a reasonable doubt, then the jury considers whether the defendant had met his burden or her burden under the defense. Now, part of your assignment this week involves reading and summarizing an Illinois case in which the defendant attempted to raise the insanity defense. I want you to really spend some time reading the court's presentation of that process, the process of presenting and then considering that defense, the various stages of that whole consideration, and all that goes into the review, analysis, and gathering the evidence regarding an insanity defense. I think it's very important because, one, as we go forward at certain times, you're going to go find your own examples of cases. So this gives you some practice in sort of breaking down court cases. But those of you who had my other courses know that you're going to do a lot of that. You're going to have to do a lot of that in your career. You're going to have to go out and find cases a lot of times, but you're going to be presented with cases or be searching for cases, because that's how we determine how these statutes apply and how the law applies. The courts tell us over parameters of facts and the spectrum of different cases how the law is going to be applied. Now, the burden of proof is on the defendant to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the defendant is not guilty by reason of insanity. So let's review burdens of proof. Clear and convincing evidence is a medium-level burden of proof which must be met for certain convictions or judgments, or in this case, the defense. It's more rigorous than preponderance of the evidence, which we use in civil cases, but less rigorous than what the prosecution has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. So how do you kind of get your mind around this? Well, the easiest way for us is to think about the scales of justice. The scales of justice is a common visual to represent the justice system. You've probably seen pictures of Lady Justice. Lady Justice looks like the Statue of Liberty. She has a blindfold on and she's holding a scale. And so if you would take your hands and place your hands palms up, shoulder width. Now, hands are level right there. All right, that's neither guilty or not guilty. Preponderance of the evidence is the burden of proof for a civil case. Preponderance of the evidence would be if you just raise your right hand slightly above your shoulder and your left hand slightly below your left shoulder, that's preponderance of the evidence. Beyond a reasonable doubt would be if you take your right hand and raise it as far as you can, keeping your palm up, and then you take your left hand and you lower it as far as you can. Now your scales of justice has been tipped as far as it can go. That's beyond a reasonable doubt. That represents pretty much the burden of proof. Now, clear and convincing is somewhere between that preponderance of evidence and beyond a reasonable doubt. You're raising those, raise your right hand, just, you did a little above your shoulder, You're not raising all the way up, somewhere in between in your left hand. You're not going as far down as you can. It's lower than just a little below your shoulder. That's clear and convincing. And those are our burdens of proof. So keep that in mind, that within the same case, the prosecution has to prove the elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. So the strictest of standards. And then if the jury believes the prosecution has done that, then the defendant gets consideration for their insanity defense, but the jury only has to find that the defendant was or had met their burden of the insanity defense by clear and convincing evidence, much less than beyond a reasonable doubt. When you think of it in those terms, you'll understand that while it's often a defense we hear a lot about, it's not a defense we see raised successfully in many cases. It gets complicated. And again, if you get into the CRJ 230 course, or if you're in it now, you think in terms of those burdens and the evidence that has to be presented. In the insanity defense, the scenario is going to be the defendant has an expert. Someone who can determine what their mental capacity was at the time of the incident. Their mental disease or mental defect, and that they lacked substantial capacity to appreciate the criminality of their conduct. And the prosecution will have their own expert, likely to say that, you know, even if they had a mental defect or you know, they were in a situation where they had a mental defect, they could appreciate the criminality of their conduct. This is what we're covering this week. These defenses, as we get into next week, where we go into self-defense and defense of others and use of force, are a little more difficult to get your mind around, but it's something you need to be aware of. And especially, you know, I wanted to spend some time on this insanity defense because you hear that one. It's kind of like, you know, the most sensational one. It's the one that people want to talk about. But again, just kind of get your head around how difficult it is for a defendant to prove this, and then why we don't see it raised that often, and why it's not so very successful even when it is raised. That's what we're covering this week in week three. Next week we move to self-defense, defense of others, and use of force. And after that, then we start getting into our offenses, and we're going to get into solicitation and conspiracy. I appreciate your efforts these first 2 weeks. Keep up the energy. If you need me, you know where to find me.